Everybody. Well, good morning, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to say we were bringing you some Christmas cheer. But we are releasing today the budget policy statement and the half-year update. The budget 2011 will continue the government's focus on rebalancing the economy and lifting economic growth. It'll be delivered against the background of an economy that has been improving consistently, if slowly, over the last year or so. We've had five quarters of growth. Unemployment has peaked and is falling. Households have been saving more and spending less. And that is an adjustment that's needed to build a strong platform for growth in the future. Budget 2011 will reinforce the government's path back to fiscal surplus by 2015-16 and sooner if possible, as the government plays its own part in lifting national savings and rebalancing the economy. Economic growth in 2010 has been more subdued than we've seen in recent recoveries. Households have been more cautious this time. They're getting their balance sheets in order by spending less and saving more. And that is after a pretty uniquely sized credit binge through the mid-2000s. The Canterbury earthquake will have impacted negatively on growth in the last quarter, but reconstruction activity, which will be on a significant scale, is going to help lift growth as we look through into next year. So the outlook is for steady recovery to continue. Real GDP growth is forecast to rise from 2.2% in the year to March 2011 to 3.4% in the following year and about 3% per year after that. There's no doubt though that the year to March 2011 has turned out to be more subdued than was expected in the budget. Unemployment peaked about this time last year at 7.1% and has fallen. It's expected to continue falling steadily as the labour market recovers, as activity increases and more new jobs are created. The terms of trade remain high because of increased global demand for commodities, dairy, meat, wood products. The forecast to remain strong, and that is critical to the rebalancing of the economy. Strong export prices underpinning export growth and consumers saving more. In the last year, we've witnessed a large turnaround in household savings behaviour. This is a graph a bit similar to the one I think we showed when we released the annual accounts back in October. But in this case, measuring the percentage of disposable income that households are saving. Through the mid-2000s, households were effectively undertaking large equity withdrawal. They probably weren't actually running their equity down because they had the sense that their house values were growing strongly. But they were withdrawing the wealth that they held in their homes. This is now rapidly reversed, as we said before. In fact, the rate at which households are adding to their equity, and that is a broad indicator of savings, is the highest it's been in 20 years. And this is the principal reason why domestic spending is flat, and that is having an impact particularly on retailing and to some extent the domestic construction sector. So for individual businesses, they experience that as pretty patchy spending, some of them doing reasonably well, some of them not. One of the effects of this is that interest rates are forecast to be lower for longer. Household savings rates are one of the factors feeding into a lower interest rate track over the next few years. In the March NPS earlier this year, the Reserve Bank were expecting 90-day rates to reach 6% by early 2013, they're now expecting the rates to remain under 4.5% over that over the length of that curve. So one of the challenges for the country and for the government is to get faster economic growth without interest rates rising significantly, and preferably without the exchange rate rising significantly as well. In line with the improving economy, the current account deficit is forecast to widen from its current lows. However, the deficits are expected to be smaller than were forecast in Budget 2010. And this reflects in part a rebalancing of the economy, of growth driven more by exports and less by domestic consumption. Because the current account deficits are smaller, you can see that there will be some improvement in New Zealand's net international investment position, and then a more gradual deterioration. So the way to see this graph is that the white line is the forecast of the budget, which showed, for instance, that our external position was heading towards 100% of GDP, minus 100% of GDP. Now it's heading towards minus 90% of GDP. This is reflected to some extent in the discussion we had a few weeks ago about Standard & Poor's. So on the budget forecast, they lifted the negative outlook. The forecasts are now better, and they put the negative outlook back on. But nevertheless, it highlights the fact that we need to focus on reducing that vulnerability. And that's why the savings working group is important. The government's contribution to national savings is important. In the near term, the fiscal outlook is softer. Before I get into the numbers here, I just want to make three points. First, this year was always going to see the government post the largest deficit in the current cycle. And that is appropriate because it's the way in which the government has set out to protect New Zealanders from the worst effects of recession, support jobs through a significant infrastructure investment, and keep public services going. Second, the deficit position here has been affected by a number of one-offs. Probably the largest of those is the $1.5 billion cost of the Canterbury earthquake. So that is the initial cost to the earthquake commission of the Canterbury earthquake coverage, and that is all being booked in this year. They've currently paid out around $350 million. But during this financial year, we're booking the whole of the $1.5 billion cost. There's also a few other one-offs, such as booking the full cost of the weather-tight homes scheme that the government announced quite a bit earlier in the year, and, of course, some lower tax revenue from a more subdued economy, particularly through the September quarter. Thirdly, we've always said that these kind of large deficits can't continue indefinitely. In fact, this forecast deficit is at the outer limits of the government's comfort zone. I'd point out here that the deficit is expected to halve in the next financial year, so it'll be reduced to about 2.8% of GDP, and the track to surplus has not fundamentally altered because of the one-off effects this year. We're still heading for surplus at 2015-16, just as we forecast in the budget. So just to go through the numbers, the operating deficit before gains and losses will peak at $11.1 billion, or 5.5% of GDP this year. The cash deficit is now forecast to peak at $15.6 billion, or 7.7% of GDP this year, and we're still on track to reach surplus in 2015-16. So that that combination of effects for the 10-11 year will have some impact on our debt track. In the last couple of budgets, the debt track's been coming down and has been forecast to peak below 30% of GDP. So the position rises about one percentage point higher from 27.5% of GDP that was forecast in the budget to 28.5% now. In terms of the numbers the government is focusing on, it's probably the external indebtedness as a percentage of GDP that we showed you earlier that we'll be focusing on. So that is the position with respect to the half-year update on the government's books. The government, of course, is, would prefer that we hadn't had those one-off costs, but that's what the government is here to do, to support the city, the Canterbury region through the earthquake, to deal with long-standing problems such as leaky homes. But it does emphasise the importance of sticking to the spending disciplines that are in place and understanding that we're in a world where there are risks that we have to absorb, but we can't let those risks put us off track to getting back to surplus. I now just want to give you a quick run through the investment statement which we're publishing today. New Zealand's led the world in the past in public sector financial reporting, producing a wide range of documents that give probably about the highest level of transparency of any developed country. But they do tend to focus on the operating flows, not on the government's capital investment. And they don't provide an easily accessible view of what the government owns on behalf of the taxpayer and what is happening to those taxpayers' assets. So the investment statement sets out in one place the assets and liabilities that make up the Crown's balance sheet. It makes some projections about what is going to happen with investment in the Crown's assets and provides an opportunity for government to make much more transparent priorities about capital investment. So why do we worry about all that? Well, the Crown assets are very large. The statement today puts the value of them at $223 billion, so it's five times the size of the New Zealand stock market. These assets are also growing quickly, so the Crown will be investing by 2015 a net $33 billion extra in its currently held assets. In fact, the gross investment over that time is around $70 billion. So the Crown will be making $70 billion of effectively new investment decisions, and the offset is largely depreciation. So the focus has traditionally been on a very small fraction of that investment. So in the budget, we look at about less than $1.5 billion of new spending. That's the only bit that has been traditionally visible to the government, $1.5 billion of new spending, which is less than a quarter of the new spending each year. Just to give you a bit more detail on it, this is all set out in the statement. We have what's called social assets, around just over $100 billion. Commercial assets, 52, I'll come back to that. The Crown Financial Institutions, that's ACC, GSF, New Zealand Super Fund, Reserve Bank, and DMO. So about half the assets are social assets. The remainder are split between commercial assets and financial assets. Just with respect to the commercial assets, once you actually net off the debt and a valuation of Kiwi Rail, which the accountants tell us is worth $11 billion, where a commercial value would be probably less than zero, the net equity in SOEs is actually only around $12 to $15 billion. So they are quite a small part of the total that is owned by the Crown. And that's set out there in some detail. What has actually been more interesting and more relevant to our decision-making processes is that in a capital-constrained economy where businesses struggle every day to get sufficient capital to grow, and at a time when we are borrowing extensively in world markets. Government is looking at gross new investment of here $71 billion by 2015 and a net increase in assets of $33 billion by 2015. So there is no doubt at all that the government is on a pretty aggressive investment track. I have to say, not by deliberate plan. This is information we have dug out of the public sector to find out what the public sector as a whole is doing. And for the first time, a cabinet will have the opportunity to look at what the government's total investment is and, more importantly, to work out whether what's happening reflects the government's priorities, because that may not be the case. So what have we found? Some of our assets are not being used nearly efficiently as they could be. There's a huge opportunity cost of this capital. Just remember where it comes from. It comes from PAYE payments, from wage earned salary earners who pay over their $150, $200, $300 a week, and from people who pay their power bills. That's it. There is nowhere else to source. Road user charges is the other source. That's where the assets come from. They don't come out of the sky. They have been paid for in cash by New Zealanders. And we believe we need to be much more assertive about how we use those assets, because the opportunity cost is huge. If you use the public sector discount rate, holding these assets generates an opportunity cost of $18 billion per year. $18 billion per year. So that's, for instance, about 50% more than what we spend on the health budget in any given year. And in the past, we paid almost no attention to reducing that opportunity cost or making sure we get some of that $18 billion as value for the taxpayer. So a couple of examples where we could do better. The Ministry of Education has 244 closed schools, teacher houses and other assets. Probably an example on a larger scale is Housing New Zealand. Housing New Zealand is larger than all the SOEs put together, and they have said themselves that roughly a third of their $15 billion of assets are the wrong size, in the wrong condition, in the wrong place. We think we can be much smarter than that. The recently released Defence White Paper highlights the opportunities that could be available if we really focus on this. And the Defence White Paper, for instance, are looking at making very significant capital and operating savings in order to move resources from administration and back office to frontline highly trained personnel and better military gear. And we would expect to achieve that over the next 4 or 5 years without putting in extra capital. Looking ahead to Budget 2011, the government's been talking for some time about the challenges, particularly around national savings. We have talked in the past about New Zealand's vulnerability to grumpy international financial markets. We need to reduce that vulnerability, that is, borrow less in those markets. The only way we can do that is to increase national savings. Earlier on this year, we set up the Savings Working Group to take us further down this road after the tax switch of the last budget, which we believe will help. One of the key objectives here is to try and lock in the behaviour change that's occurred in New Zealand households. And one of the big unknowns about the economic forecasts at the moment is whether New Zealanders are going to go back to their old love affair with debt and credit, or whether they have permanently changed the risks that they see around debt and permanently changed their savings habits. The other key objective is for the government to play its part in by controlling spending increases and sticking to that path back to surplus in 2016. We've got a number of reviews that were set up earlier this year which are coming to fruition in the next couple of months. That's the Savings Working Group, the Welfare Working Group, the Housing Advisory Group, and a review we've set up on spending on policy advice. And alongside that, we're issuing our investment statement today, and earlier in the new year, we will also issue version 2 of the infrastructure plan. Even small percentage gains across all of these aspects of government activity are going to make a significant difference. But I must say, we will continue with our process of making considered decisions for long-term benefit, rather than chasing large-scale short-term savings. Of course, we will look for opportunities to tighten up on budgets. And I believe the public service is in much better shape to be able to do that now than it has been at any time in the last decade. So we'll take those opportunities, but we still want to make considered decisions for long-term benefits. We're confident that the government's six pillars economic policy is still represent the right priorities for this economy, focused on rebalancing. We're also confident that the structure we've got in place for managing our fiscal pressures is adequate, but we will be looking and through the next budget to focus pretty strongly on what we can do to lift national savings and to reduce that external vulnerability, which represents a vulnerability for New Zealand, but also a break on the kind of growth that this economy needs to have if it's going to deliver the incomes that people are expecting. Any questions?
You are about $3.2 billion down on revenue between 2011 and 2014. Are you going to square that away by reducing spending by that much?
Well, as you can see from the forecasts, there's offsets to that reduction in revenue. So, for instance, we've got a lower inflation track, which means lower increases in benefit levels. So the pluses and minuses pretty much even out, and while the revenue is down, we're still on a surplus track to 2015-16. And by the end of next financial year, while we've taken some hits this financial year, by the end of next financial year, we'll be back on track.
So you won't need to cut government spending at all?
Well, just bear in mind here two things. One is we've already got it on a pretty tight constraint with this $1.1 billion increase per year. Now, that's only been in operation for 6 months so far, and it's going to be in place forever. And I think the government machine is now adapting to that reality. We will certainly be looking for opportunities to get back to surplus sooner. And in the early... Yeah, we'll be looking for opportunities to get back to surplus sooner.
What about the Welfare Working Group? How significant do you think that you might be possibly when you look at that in terms of major changes in welfare? Do you expect to make major changes?
Well, in the first place, we're not expecting significant short-term savings from it. So neither the Welfare Working Group, the Savings Working Group, or the housing one, we don't expect significant fiscal savings out of those. We want to make considered long-term decisions on their merits. But certainly anyone in those areas knows they're not going to be getting new money. But we do need to do a much better job of what we're doing there with the existing resource, and if there's long-term savings, well, that's great.
In the investment statement, it sounds as though you're mounting a case for asset sales. Now, before the next election, what detail are you going to go into?
Well, I mean, the government's position is clear about that. We've said that we'll, if we change our position from no sales, then we would put that to, we would campaign on that in the 2011 election. I think what the investment and the Prime Minister signalled that we are kicking the tyres on it, right? So we'll have a look. I think what the investment statement demonstrates is that it's actually more important that we lift the management of our assets across the board, because there's a couple of hundred billion of them. And whatever the position is about asset sales, as I said, the SOEs are a very small proportion of the family silver, and we need to be using the whole silver set much more effectively.
Thank you.
doesn't it? It's pretty explicit, though. It says that you will continue to look at private sector capital and introducing private sector capital to drive the performance of state assets. So isn't that partial privatisation?
Well, as I said, if the government changes its position, it'll make that absolutely clear. There won't be any doubt about what our position is as we go into the election, whether it's partial floats or no sale. We are introducing private sector capital and disciplines where we can. So, for instance, in the case of the prison PPP, the benefits of that, we're getting a lot of benefit from that already, even though we haven't got to the stage of doing it, because the private sector asks much tougher questions. In answering those questions, we've learnt an awful lot about what's happening with people flowing through our justice system, what actually happens with recidivism, and we're taking the lessons from that to spread across the management of all the prisons. So, you know, we don't have to do PPPs, but if we want to raise the level of management of $200 billion of assets, we're not going to do it with the traditional civil service model where capital's free, so you waste it. We need to bring in skills about managing the operational and financial risks. So that's really what we're... That's the ultimate objective, and these other things are just tools for achieving it.
Surely the unspoken thing with the investment statement is that you want to shift some of that $225 billion worth of investment in social and commercial assets off the Crown balance sheet and onto the private sector.
Well, from an accounting point of view, you actually can't move it off the Crown balance sheet unless you actually get right out of the business. So no, it's not really about trying to shift stuff off balance sheet. There's been arguments in the UK about that, and we're quite happy with a very transparent system that if we're fully funding the cost of an asset like a prison, then it sits on our balance sheet. What we're really after is just better management of it. The opportunity cost of holding $200 billion of assets is $18 billion a year, and we're not delivering value to the people who paid for it, and they paid cash for it, right? We need to do a better job than we've been doing.
If they're not delivering value, why not sell them?
What's that?
If they're not delivering value, why not sell them?
Well, that's a very generalised statement. Why not sell them? We've got $200 billion of assets. We're not going to be selling $200 billion of assets under any circumstances. What we're doing here is just getting the picture clear in the first place. So it's been a bit of a revelation to the Cabinet, and I think to most people, about the size of what the taxpayer owns. It then puts in perspective the need for policies that allow you to make some decisions about priorities. So the government's priorities have been the roading network, the rollout of broadband, and upgrading the electricity grid. Now that's in the future, the question will be, should we be borrowing more money overseas for that, or can we manage our own assets better to fund that without having to borrow so much?
You talk about disposing of these assets past.
Oh no! Look, I mean, if you take an example like the excess education assets, they're caught up in a number of processes. In fact, that's one of the challenges for the public sector. Is it's got assets that it clearly can't use, but it is difficult to move them on because they've got to go through the Public Works Act, you've got to go through the treaty land banking process, and sometimes there's other special criteria that apply. So we do need, but we don't want them sitting around. You know, education's got 100 million of assets just sitting around, and we've got new schools to build. So we need to really do a better job of moving that stuff on so we can free up the capital for higher, for building new schools.
What are you doing about that?
Oh, well, what we're doing about it is, as I said in the first place, getting the information together. We're changing a lot of the internal rules about use of capital so that the public service will be much more careful about how they bid for new capital. And we do need to focus on just the issues that were raised here, and that is the disposal processes are long and complicated, even for assets that aren't worth that are no particular use to anybody in the public sector. So we are going to have to address those administrative processes so that we can free up cash.
It's not a very, it's also, on the flip side, it's not a very good market to be selling property into at the moment.
Well, it depends what it is, doesn't it? I mean, we're not at risk of extensive sale here. We've got a lot of work to do to tidy all this up. We're just step one. Step one has been get the information out. Probably where we can make the most difference is on the pressure for new investment. So we've had to say to, for instance, the health sector, that their capital processes, their processes for bidding for new capital are low quality. They've become quite politicised in the last 10 years, and we need to get it much more onto the basis of showing us what new services and new benefits to patients we're going to get, not just some new buildings, because that's the easy bit. The question is, what change are we buying? It's the same with large-scale investments in IT. The government's got several billion dollars of IT investments in the pipeline, and it's never really worked on those systematically in the past. So we want to make sure that any public agency that comes forward with an IT investment can show us not just that they're renewing the capacity they've got, but that they're driving organisational change and better services. Because in the end, we've got to provide better services for less money. And some of the government departments now are really, their only assets are IT systems. So IRD, MSD, don't own buildings, almost none. I don't think IRD own any buildings. The $160 million of public equity is almost all IT. And about a third of it gets written off each year. Department of Statistics the same. They've run theirs has run right down over the last 15 years. So this isn't just about a few things like PPPs or your traditional political arguments. This is about a major shift in the public sector respecting public capital, treating it with respect and using it effectively, particularly because when they waste it, we've got to go and borrow more from the same people who are lending to Spain and Portugal. And they're going to be asking harder and harder questions. And I don't want to be going over there saying, yeah, we're borrowing more because we're wasting capital at home on stuff we don't need and that doesn't provide a good service.
Have you considered cancelling the reduction of the company tax rate from 38 to 28?
Have you considered that someone
might be able to
afford to do that? No, we haven't. We're not undoing any of the tax package. It's a sensible package. I think in the long run it is going to have significant impact on the incentives to rebalance the economy. You know, with respect to the fiscal track, we've got a period of lower tax revenue and then a number of significant one-off costs which any government would expect to pick up, and we do so wanting to do a good job. For instance, of the Christchurch earthquake, we're not penny pinching just because things are a bit tight, because that's a long-term rebuild for a city. So we're not going, this is, the figures are not so good this year, but that's not throwing us off our policy track, because we think our policy track's about right.
What was the overall impact on the tax take-up? Three rounds of tax cuts, going back to the first round that Labor introduced?
Oh, well, look, if we go back to October 2008, it would be quite significant. I couldn't tell you. Of course, in the last round, we offset the income tax cuts with increases in GST, tobacco, and tax on foreign owners of New Zealand assets.
At that time, though, your predecessors stood there and kept on being asked whether these surpluses, structural surpluses, and why wasn't he cutting tax? I'm just wondering, how confident are you that this deficits now are just simply cyclical and they'll just work through the system?
Well, we're confident we can get back to surplus, but we, as I think the Prime Minister said yesterday, we're on the outer edge of what we would regard as acceptable. There's some debate about whether the significant increase in spending, particularly from 2005 onwards, amounted to a structural increase in spending. That is, there's an argument that says some of it is. We believe we've got a track where with constraint on the new spending and the new capital, we can get back to surplus. But we've got to, as I said, we've got to get into the position where we can handle another recession and another earthquake. And frankly, we won't be there before 2020. By the time we get back to surplus, we've committed to contributions to the super fund once we get to surplus. So that'd take us another $2.5 billion. You've got to be plus $2.5 billion to manage that. Then you need some kind of cyclical buffer. And it will certainly be 2020 before we could expect to reach that position. So we're in a vulnerable fiscal position for the next 6 or 8 years, and that's why we need to stick to the track and stick to the discipline. One thing these figures do make clear is there's no spend up in election year. There cannot be a lolly scramble in 2011. No amount of wishful thinking can make that possible.
It's more than an argument, though, isn't it, about whether these deficits are structural? You've got both the Treasury and the Reserve Bank saying they are largely structural and talking about numbers like 4 or 5% of GDP. Doesn't that mean you are going to have to lower the spending track by a similar sort of amount over time?
Well, look, the Treasury, the IMF, the OECD all give pretty assertive advice about fiscal management. We believe we've got about the right balance between managing our way through a recession, maintaining long-term investments in public services, and showing a track back to surplus. Now, it's been tested a bit this year with these one-off events. We've made sure that we're pretty sure that the 2011 budget is going to show us on the same track as we were in the 2010 budget, looking through to 2015-16.
You say that part of the $1.1 billion allowance for new spending will in fact be set aside to cope with things normally outside that we have an uptake risk. Can you give us some indication of how much of the $1.1 billion isn't going to be really for new initiatives, but you can't control?
Well, we've yet to finalise that, but there's particular areas of government spending where for historical reasons, they've been left out. And the example referred to in the, I think, in the fiscal statement, or might be the budget policy statement, is education. So if you compare education to health, in health, they get an allocation for the year, and that's it. They have to manage their IT and their salaries and their costs of capital all within that new allocation. In the case of education, what happens is they get an allocation, and then if there's any increases in demand, for instance, in early childhood or salary increases, traditionally the government's just written out another cheque. Well, we don't do that anywhere else in the public service. And so in the last budget and this budget, we're bringing education into line with everyone else. And that is, they will get an allocation, and it's their job within that to manage salary demands, increases in things like early childhood or after-school care or whatever. And that'll just mean I'll have to focus a bit more instead of sending the taxpayer the bill.
Could you tell us a little bit about the policy review advice or the policy advice review? Is that going to result in job losses of additional public service?
Oh, that'd be jumping to conclusions. The question was about the policy advice review. I think the first impact of the policy advice review is everyone decided to reclassify their activities out of policy advice into something else. So once we track that issue down, we'll start making a few decisions.
How do you catch Australia with these growth forecasts? What's your own words of
wisdom? We won't catch them in the short term, that's for sure. They've had a massive impact from the price of their resources, the iron ore and so on. Remember, we're still dealing with the aftermath of a financially driven recession, and the lesson from around the world is that recovery from that sort of recession takes a bit longer. But we believe that we're laying the platform for stronger growth later, and that is a combination of changes in savings habits, which could have, if we can lock them in, would have a very significant impact for the economy, investment in infrastructure, sorting out the public sector. We've certainly got a better tax system than the Australians now. We're heading for better regulatory regimes than the Australians. And those are the things which over 10 or 15 years make a considerable difference.
You're looking to reprioritise another $2 billion worth of expenditure from different departments to other programs?
There will be quite a lot of reprioritisation going on, but what this particular feature of this, it's getting a bit harder. The first couple of years there was a lot of low-hanging fruit just left over from the years of plenty. But now the departments are looking out over 3 or 4 years in this budget and looking at how they're going to manage their costs against a flat income. Right, so most of them get no new money and they've got rising costs. So they need to show that they can manage that over time without pulling down the service. You know, they have to focus on at least the same, if not better service, and doing it for less money. And I'll get to look at those things over the next 6 weeks or so.
What areas are you looking to take money from?
Well, that varies an awful lot by department. Their main costs are pretty straightforward, and that is rising wages and salaries. And IT costs, they're the two biggest components. And we've provided a range of tools for them to help them manage those costs. So there's centralised procurement, there's benchmarking of all their costs, and they're starting to pick up those tools. So I'm pretty confident, actually, that they'll manage the next couple of years. Years 3 and 4 will look a bit trickier.
Okay. Isn't the fastest way to improve national savings to actually reduce that structural deficit?
Oh, look, as I've said before, we had the choice of following some of the advice, and that is going in, putting interest back on student loans, cutting working for families in half, dropping a level of national super. We've decided not to do those things, particularly through a recession. And if we were going to make any change in that position, then we would be signalling that clearly to the electorate.
Have you had any advice on the impacts of credit growth numbers? Because, I mean, they're looking very, very, very low. I mean, historically speaking, unprecedentedly low.
Yeah, credit growth is very low. In the short run, that does mean that does make for a more subdued recovery. But in the long run, we need to change our addiction to credit. I mean, when it was growing at 25 or 30% a year, that was far too high. It's probably got a bit low, and it'll come back to somewhere near a normal range over the next 4 or 5
years. Does that possibly mean that the growth forecasts might be a bit optimistic?
Well, look, the growth forecasts I would describe as moderate. We're in a world where we're subject to uncertainties, but on the basis of these forecasts, we think we're still on track. Thank you very much.
We ran right up against the embargo there, sorry folks, but you can connect and see it straight away. Thank you.